welcome to the Picture House podcast. My name is Sarah Cook and I'm going to be your host for this very special interview. We're delighted to be talking to Panos Cosmatos. Now, if you don't know that name, he is an Italian-Canadian cult film director whose previous work includes Beyond the Black Rainbow. But we're here to talk about the wonderful, magnificent, brutal, beautiful, Nick Cage-led horror, Mandy. Now, you may have seen Mandy splattered across the underground, splattered across London, all on the internet. There's been a much hype for this film since the first gorgeous poster dropped, and word of mouth does not disappoint. Mandy is very much a midnight audience, culture shock-esque audience, and basically revolves around Red Miller, played by Nicolas Cage, who is an audience favourite, and his partner Mandy, the titular Mandy, played by our best actress in Britain, Andrea Riseborough, and the pair live isolated in the Shadow Mountains, and their idyllic lives are disrupted by a cult gang led by the egocentrical Jeremiah Sands. When he can't have his way, things are going to get dark. I'm going to leave it there because this is one of the films that's best experienced for the first time with fresh eyes. It's a beautiful and brooding film. It's one half an artistic slow romp through colours and sights and sounds, and a second half a Nick Cage-led attack, and I think you're in for a really, really good thrill ride. It's got music by the late Johan Johansson. It's got stunning visuals. Linus Roach plays the villain Jeremiah Sands, and he does a fantastic job. And you are going to get what you want, but also there's going to be some free surprises along the way. We'd like to be joined by Panos Cosmatos, and I'll take you straight to the interview we conducted. How are you today?
I'm okay, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very good. How are you feeling about screening the film at BFI London Film Festival?
I'm stoked. I can't wait for people to see it, more people to see it, you know.
Had a really interesting screening last night. How was that, screening it in a church?
It was great. It was like a King Diamond show or something, you know? That's what it felt like in there. Really, I'm really excited about the movie coming to London because one of my earliest memories, we lived here briefly when I was quite young, maybe four or five years old. And I remember being in the underground, London Underground, and there was subway ads for Phantasm everywhere, and they terrified me. They were like these harbingers of doom all over the walls. I didn't know what they meant. I didn't know what to make of them. The imagery was so startling and bizarre. It was like the most scary thing I'd ever seen at the time. So coming here and having Mandy ads in the underground is kind of like, feels like a weird circle has been completed.
That really weird, impeccable imagery. You're kind of hoping that some child is going to see them and be like, whoa.
Sure.
And obviously you're doing a really lovely run at the Prince Charles, which I think is perfect for the film. Really good cult audience. But
right.
Before I talk about that, where did the idea come from?
After my dad died, I went into therapy and started dealing with my grief. And I was finally able to sort of gain some clarity after 10 years of, you know, kind of going down a spiral after my mom died. And maybe this is a very long way of going about saying where the idea came from. But, you know, at a certain point, I started reconnecting with the sort of, you know, more sort of lowbrow genre stuff that really meant a lot to me growing up. And at some point, I ended up watching all of the Death Wish films in a row. And when you watch all of the films in a series or in a, you know, a whole bunch of movies in a genre in one sitting, it kind of gives you a chance to sort of ruminate on the machinations of that genre and the structures of it and how it works and what you like about it and what you don't like about it and what you think could be done with something like that, with that sort of structure. And I sort of came to this thought of wanting to make a revenge film that centered around the orbit of the essence of the person that was being avenged as much as about the person who was enacting it. And then, you know, I sort of landed on it. I wanted it to be kind of like a love song about that person in a weird way, named after them, you know, sort of like a strange album about them, you know.
I mean, it's personally my favorite of the festival so far, and probably one of my favorite films of the year, and so beautifully shot. And a lot of that really depends on Mandy and who plays Mandy. How did you decide on I mean, one of Britain's best actresses, Andrea Riseborough, for the role of Mandy, because she's such a beautiful but haunting actress.
Well, I'd seen her in Birdman and that television program National Treasure, and was like kind of stunned that it was the same person, and started to realize that I'd seen her in other things, and that she had this amazing chameleonic ability. But it also, you know, she's sort of something about her physicality and the way she looked reminded me of you know, a medieval queen or a metal woman from the 80s at the same time, you know, which maybe have some crossover there. There was a moment, you know, when she came and we were doing costume and hair tests, and they tried some eye makeup on her, and she said, you know, Panos, I think I really want Mandy to be more androgynous. And the second she said that, it's something in my mind just clicked, and I realized that I'd gotten the right person and that it was going to be something really special.
Yeah, absolutely. Because her presence is still felt even after her tragic demise. She's still throughout the film, still thinking about those haunting eyes.
Well, I wanted her to feel like somebody that you wanted to get to know further, and you were not going to have maybe the ability to, it's about somebody that you love dearly being taken out of the world forever, and you know, it can never be retrieved, you know? So I wanted Mandy to be somebody that you would miss, and that her kind of effect on the world was missed, you know.
And it's just beautifully well done. And obviously, you kind of have to believe that Red would go to the ends of his mentality for her. What made Nick Cage the perfect person to do this?
Well, originally, I didn't think he was. You know, I wanted him to play the villain, and I was told that he was interested in playing the villain. And I went and met with him in Vancouver, and he said, "I don't want to play the villain. I want to play Red Miller." I'd become a little bit obsessed with the idea of him playing the villain, and I'd rewritten the dialogue of Jeremiah Sand, you know, with him in mind. And, you know, I was disillusioned, and I thought, well, that's it. You know, I don't really think he's right for Red Miller. But a few weeks later, I had a dream where I was watching the movie Mandy completed with him in it, and it was so undeniably compelling and dynamic and interesting, him being in that role. That I the first thing I did was I woke up and I called the producers and said, you know, I think we have to call him immediately and see if we can make this work. I noticed you're wearing Mamma Mia glasses.
I know. I kind of work in a cinema, and I get like loads of merch, and these are fake. It's purely for look and style.
ABBA was like the first music I ever heard, I think.
Oh yeah, wow. There's definitely like the 80s and 70s-esque influence in Mandy as well. I certainly love Jeremiah Sand's album.
Right.
No wonder that Mandy laughs right in his face.
Yeah.
For it. Was like metal and 70s music and the imagery so influential in Mandy and development of Mandy?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, you know, with Black Rainbow in this film, I was kind of trying to reconnect with the stuff that really inspired me growing up, to sort of tap into that idea of an imaginary film that you would get from, you know, that I would look at these horror covers of the VHS boxes and sort of tap into those things. I sort of delved heavy and deep back into all the things that really resonated with me or inspired me or, you know, fired my imagination when I was a kid. And other than ABBA, which I actually loved dearly, metal was the next step after that, where I really, with music that I really connected with emotionally and felt like it was a whole other world that I could sort of lose myself in.
Yeah. There's something really, I think, unique about metal music that does inspire this kind of fantastical world that Mandy really perfectly honors and tributes.
I mean, early on, I thought to myself, this movie is kind of like, Not the world that's shown on the van art, but this is a movie about the people who drive the van with the van art on it.
That's a perfect description.
If they were going to have an experience somewhat like what's in the van art.
Absolutely. That's great. That's how I'm going to sell it to more people. Going back to the acting, so you lost Nick Cage as the villain, but you managed to create Linus Roach as Jeremiah Sands. He does a really, really good job at balancing a sinister villain, but a petulant child with a massive ego really well.
Yeah, that's funny because he's just the nicest, sweetest man in reality. Yeah, I was a bit nervous and trepidatious about trying to find a European actor to play Jeremiah, because in North America, there's thousands of Jeremiah Sands in the world. Every time I go to the grocery store, I see two or three Jeremiah Sands, and there's plenty of actors that I feel could perfectly, you know, capture the essence of that. But trying to find Jeremiah Sand in Europe was a bit more challenging, I think, just because it's something that's so specific to the geography of where I live, you know. But I just knew that Linus was such an amazing actor, and he had lived in America for a long time and had experiences in his life with weird religious people that I think kind of allowed him to understand where I was coming from, you know. Yeah. Also, he was in Chronicles of Riddick, so I was like, sold. That's all I need to hear. He was the purifier in Chronicles of Riddick. That's all I needed to hear, really.
Sold.
He does a really good job at bringing the ego of a wannabe rock star into the ego-ness of evangelistic behavior. There's quite a, not, I wouldn't say anti-religion, but anti-organized religion and cult religion in this film.
Yeah. I went through a thing, you know, around the same time that I was writing this, where I decided to sort of reject all superstition from my life, because I accumulated a lot of them over the years. You know, some of them given to my parents from the old world, and some of them devised, you know, by my own, you know, neurotic mind. And I just decided to make a clean break with it and just reject all of it and try to free my mind from that stuff. But I also realized that just by osmosis, I had accumulated a lot of fear in my life, based on religious beliefs that weren't really mine, that had just been kind of implanted in me haphazardly, or, you know, as I move through the world, that's how virulent it can be, you know? So, yeah, I think it's an anti-religious movie, actually. Yeah,
which makes it funnier that you had it at Temple yesterday at screening. But you get some really gorgeous locations in this as well. The Shadow Mountains and that area, was that always in your mind, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's amazing what you can do with a smoke machine and some lights in a forest, you know? So I knew as long as we had a forest, we were going to be okay.
Yeah. And was that a house out there, or was this something that you guys built? Because it's a very, like, makeshift.
It was built onto an existing structure that was incomplete. Yeah, our amazing production designer, Herbert Puil, was able to do that. Wow. It was really great to work with him. He worked on a film that I really loved called The Passion of Darkly Noon that Philip Ridley made, that I think floated in the back of my mind in some way when I was writing Mandy. So it was kind of amazing to work with him.
Yeah, there's a great bit of production design where it flips into this brightly colored 70s patterned bathroom.
Yeah.
Where he's having his grief breakdown. Yeah. Was that like an active choice for all of you, like to go from this neon and colors of red and green to?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted that scene in particular to feel almost like you had stumbled into like some weird one act off Broadway play in like the East Village or something, where some guy was doing his like personal one act play about you know, his emotional breakdown, and I wanted to feel like that, because it's like when you're going through a nervous breakdown or grief or something like that, the whole world can seem to become a kind of like synthetic enemy to you, you know, something that you're not truly a part of anymore, you know, that you're just floating through it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the use of colors, impeccable. Because there's a lot of neon in horror at the moment, in horror films. I mean, what did you enjoy about working with those palettes? And
well, I mean, when I decided to make Black Rambo, I decided that I went through, you know, a long period of thinking about, you know, how to present that particular world. And for a time, I was thinking about doing the whole film in very high contrast black and white. But over the course of writing it, I realized that I just love color too much. And every color is like a different flavor, a different emotion. And then I instead of trying to avoid that, I wanted to completely embrace it and just fill my films with texture and color and you know, have them be really like almost sensory experiences.
It just helps the whole dreamscape of Mandy come alive, but also that the horror, it really juxtaposes against the gritty horror of it all. Were there any influences that you had?
I think I was a little bit more sort of driven by like Excalibur and actual barbarian films instead of horror films. One exception, I think, would be the scene where Red is tied to the fence and they come out to kill him. And I think that was actually sort of inspired a little bit by Last House on the Left. But it was kind of a pragmatic decision at the same time, because we had so little time and we had to like simplify our lighting setup. So I said, you know, and Ben, the DP, had this like amazing lighting setup planned, and we just didn't have time to set it. So I said, we're just going to shoot it like the Hills Have Eyes, or sorry, like Last House on the Left, just put a floodlight on it And I think that'll work. And it did.
And obviously you have this amazing score by the late, great Johan Johansson.
Yeah.
How did that develop?
Well, I guess, weirdly enough, you know, I never thought that he would want to work with me on this film. I didn't know, you know, I thought of him as a very, like, academic, austere man, and that he'd have zero interest in me or what I was doing. But it turned out that he'd actually seen Beyond the Black Rainbow, like some musicians had sort of been gravitated towards that film and wanted to work on what I was doing next, if it was something along those lines. At the same time, I was, I didn't know what to expect. But after talking to him for a few minutes, I realized that he was originally an Icelandic metalhead, and that we had a lot of like similar touchstones in our youths, and that he really was interested in exploring the same things on this film, something a little bit more disintegrating and a little bit more textural than what he normally does. But I felt lucky to get him, you know, because I think that music cue in Sicario, where the SWAT team is descending into the shadowy valley at sunset, is like one of the greatest music cues in cinema history.
It just does feel like that classic 70s metal and rock music.
Yeah, we wanted to sort of evoke that without aping it, you know, sort of like interpret it without just copying it, you know.
It's really well done. I mean, this film is just a phenomenal watch, and there's some really interesting camera setups. That layering that you do with Jeremiah and Mandy is one of the best things I've seen in cinema for a very long time. How did that come about?
It was like a combination of this thing that I read by the writer Brian Geisen, which was like a meditative exercise where you stare into your own eyes in the mirror for a very long time, and eventually your face will completely change, and you'll see many different strangers' faces, and everything around your eyes will change. And I attempted that a few times, and it's like a really an intense kind of a perceptual experience. And so, yeah, I think that was the seed of it, but also a sequence in Persona as well by Bergman that I had sort of jotted down in my notebook as something that I thought would be cool.
I think cool is an understatement. It is amazing. I mean, finally, it is a really like well put together and like a good one-shot film, but there's so much in that world and so much color and character. Would that be maybe not with Red, but would you explore the world of Mandy with a different story?
I don't know. I can imagine lots of other things going on in that valley in the Shadow Mountains that had nothing to do with Red Mandy, you know? I feel like there might be some interesting stuff going on there in that forest. Who knows? I suspect there is.
Well, I hope so, because it's such a beautiful forest and those planets and this color and your mind and your directing. It's just one of, again, a really beautiful, perfect cinematic experience.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for spending time and talking to me today.
Oh, it was my great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good luck with the release.
Thank you. Thank you.